Welcome to part two of our Stories from the Wild event. If you haven't listened to part one yet, go back in your podcast feed and maybe listen to that first. Now, we'll start off part two with my own story that I told that night.
It's my turn to share a story with you now, and this was fun writing it. It took me back in time. I had to dig deep for this memory. I hope you enjoy it. Squatting. I was never very good at it. I think I'm too tall or something. But this morning I had no choice. I had to master it because this morning I have giardia. And I'm a long way from the nearest toilet. And just four little sticks straddle the opening of a pit latrine underneath me. Sticks for me to place my giant feet on and hope to God that they hold my 230-pound weight. What's running through my head, my concern, is that no one at camp is this heavy, including the fellas who dug this latrine. These sticks have never had to hold someone my weight. Three things made it worse. First, I'm wearing thick blue plastic flip-flops, you know, the kind that get really rigid when it's cold, you know. Second, the sticks are covered in ice. Because I'm at 16,000 feet above sea level and it's been a very cold night. Third, I also have altitude sickness, so it feels a bit like my brain is trying to bleed out of my ears. One slip and it's all over. I am not a happy camper. Which is ironic because in 1993, 1 year earlier, all I could do was dream about being here, the Himalayas. Just 12 months ago, I'm at this major bear research conference in Alaska, surrounded by PhDs. The place is full of brainiacs. And I'm just a 24-year-old bear biologist wannabe, trying to follow my dream of becoming a fully-fledged bear guy. I'd done a little bit of work in New Hampshire and a couple of other places briefly, but I was at the conference to dream about what could be next. On the conference stage is this Pakistani bear researcher, Dr. Anis Rahman. And the room is hushed. Everybody wants to hear what he has to say. And he describes this beautiful mountain plateau. On his map, it looks like a freckle in a sea of white mountains. The giant peaks of the Karakoram Range. And he talks about what he thinks lives there, a handful of some of the rarest bears in the world. Himalayan brown bears. Like our grizzlies, but even tougher. Dr. Anis is cool and calm, and he's totally legit. He's tall with a big moustache and an air of confidence. He and his colleague, Vakar Zakaria, are trying to prove that there are still bears on this plateau, something almost impossible in a place that's this wild and this inaccessible. I remember my mind reeling as he spoke. I tried to picture being there. I don't know how, but I knew I had to get there. What a place, and what a place to learn about bears. As soon as Dr. Anis finished speaking, I grabbed my bag and I shot down the stage to introduce myself. But throngs of people swarmed him. It was like we were at some kind of rock concert. So I never got to meet him. I got home to England and I couldn't get the Himalayas, those bears. Dr. Anis couldn't get them out of my head. Maybe I should write a letter, a phone call, too expensive. Right, I'm going to fax him. Remember those? Dear Dr. Anis, we met in Alaska at the Bear Conference. Not really. I would love to come and learn from you and your team about the bears of the Himalayas. And guess what? He wrote back. Same day, I think. The fax was painfully slow. Might as well have been in Morse code, you know. I remember you well, Mr. Chris. What? Never mind, doesn't matter. I'm in. My ticket to becoming a bear biologist. A chance to learn from Pakistan's very own leading bear expert. Just became very real. I worked extra hours at the pub. I even learned how to apply for a grant. Got one. That was the flight paid for. I hoped the rest would just somehow fall into place. It did. So here I am, squatting. In the Himalayas. In Urdu, the Pakistani people call this place Land of the Giants. In front of me stretches the Deosai Plateau, From the latrine, I can almost see K2, the second highest mountain in the world. Over there is the border of Kashmir. And somewhere, maybe somewhere, some Himalayan bears. I made it, my dream gig. Although it's not the start I'd pictured, you know, diarrhea and bleeding ears and all of those things, I was still beyond excited. And it's a big day. The bosses, Dr. Anis and Vakar, are gathering the small Pakistani team here at base camp. It's like the formal start to our research season. And I'm a little bit intimidated. I can see them starting to gather in the mess tent. So I summon my courage, carefully step off my sticks, and head into the tent and sit down on the floor with the guys, and we're all cross-legged in a circle. It's all quite ceremonious. And I remember the smell inside the tent, it was intoxicating. Curried beans and warm roti, the local bread. Everyone was looking at me. Dr. Anis was first to speak, the bear biologist I'd met in Alaska. "So, Chris, tell us all about bears," he says. Weird, I thought. Must be a test to figure out what I know. So maybe I'll start at the beginning. Well, bears as carnivores. "Wait a minute, bears are carnivores?" says Anis. "Yes, bears are carnivores, you know that. You're a bear biologist," I said. And he smiles and he goes, "Oh, no. I'm a dentist." "A dentist?" I said. "Yes, I'm a dentist." "A dentist?" I said, again. "What?" I felt my jaw drop, you know, when they literally drop. And I looked over to the other boss, Vakar, hoping, just hoping, he was the bear biologist here. And Vakar here is a chemical engineer. "A chemical engineer?" I said. I don't know what to say. I almost began to cry. Honestly, I think it came out as kind of a nervous laughter, you know. What have I done? You know, I've spent every penny. I've traveled halfway around the world to learn about Himalayan brown bears from a dentist and a chemical engineer. Dr. Anis wasn't a doctor of bears. He was a doctor of teeth. Then Anis said, "We are here to save these bears." It was that landed him on the stage at the bear conference a year earlier. He was one of the very few people who knew anything about these mysterious bears. I was in shock, but also in awe, and then I was in shock again. How was I going to get the training that I'd come for? I didn't sleep much that night. Early the next morning, I woke up to the sound of one of the team members, Rashid, singing the Islamic call to prayer just a few feet away. Oh, it was beautiful. I poked my head out of the tent to watch, and I'd never seen this before, and it moved me so much. I remember lying there, feeling quite overwhelmed, and at 25 years old, not sure what I'd got myself into. But as the days unfolded, I discovered I was with a team of very special people, and I got to know them really well. Hiked mile after mile on the search for bears. They were totally driven, but they were so fun-loving and warm. Rashid, tiny man, biggest beard you've ever seen in your life, mischievous and always laughing. Halim, who was like this larger-than-life Pakistani cowboy, always rallying us with his enthusiasm. "Come on, Chris!" And Dr. Anis and Vakar at the helm. They'd brought this motley crew together on a mission for these bears in the middle of nowhere. And it turns out bears were quite new to all of them. And the limited bear research experience I'd had became more useful than I ever imagined here. And we began to learn together. I remember finding our first fresh bear tracks in the mud, but no bears. Until one day, we walked to the top of a hill next to camp. to take a look down the valley before turning in for the night, and we scanned the distance with our binoculars, not expecting to see a thing. And then, a bear, right there on the slope below us. I remember the first gasp from one of the guys, and then another bear. It was a female and a cub. Anise grabbed my shoulders tight and just hugs me. He's laughing, hugging me hard. We all hugged. I've never done a silent Irish jig, but that's exactly what we all did. We didn't want to disturb the bears. Jig quietly. And it was a huge turning point. After that, we saw bears almost every week, and we honed our skills together, racing to understand them. We'd hike for miles, crossing rivers, mountain passes, getting lost in the fog one time, and even chased down by nomadic herdsmen one day. But it didn't matter, because we were starting to see bears and dream of protecting them, like Anis and Vakar. And it worked. A year later, Anis and Vakar made sure of it. This land of the giants became a protected place for bears forever. It was designated DSI National Park. And the bear numbers? They're now growing slowly. For me, it's a place where my young mind learned things that I still carry with me today, but not about bears, about people and the human spirit. That summer of 94, I learned more than I ever saw coming from my new friends in Pakistan. I learned that it's not always about PhDs and protocol, but passion and being bold enough to do brave things. I also learned that anything is possible from a dentist and a chemical engineer who love bears. Thank you, guys. Fun going down memory lane with you there. It's now my pleasure to introduce our next storyteller. Technology has changed a lot since I got into conservation. We only used to be able to track animals with VHF radio collars, you know, when you actually had to go out and into the field. But now biologists don't even have to leave their desks to do it. You can use satellite GPS. But there's nothing that can replace this sense of curiosity. I really believe that curiosity and being a curious person is really fundamental, this characteristic to studying nature for anyone who wants to study wildlife and nature. Our next storyteller told me that she grew up in a very science-focused household. And when she's out in nature, it can be tricky for her to find a balance between being precise and analytical versus just being. Please welcome Keturah Reynolds to the stage.
The year was 1997. It was Bill Clinton's second term in office. Princess Diana's days were numbered, and Mother Teresa would pass away soon after. The first Toyota Prius was about to hit the streets, and Comet Hale-Bopp was blazing its way across the night sky. The Titanic movie was pretty big. And some of you, yes, some of you were not even born yet. But me, I had just completed my bachelor's degree in fine art at the University of California at Santa Cruz. And wildlife was actually a big part of why I chose that school. 4 years earlier, on my informal evening tour of the campus, I couldn't even see most of the university's buildings because the redwood trees were so thick. But I did see more than a dozen deer wandering the campus that night. And I also spotted the very first wild bobcat that I had ever seen in my life. There were mountain lion warnings posted prominently in all of the school's restrooms. And our school mascot was a bright yellow banana slug. Thank you very much. Forget you, UC Berkeley. All I saw on your campus was a squirrel jumping in and out of a garbage can. Now, I majored in art because UC Santa Cruz had an amazing program in science illustration at the time. And it's at this point that everyone asks, what is science illustration? Don't worry, I got you on that. Think of the drawings that you see in textbooks or in newspapers or in the doctor's office. Diagrams of how eyeballs work, animations showing the movement of fault lines during an earthquake, or extinct dinosaurs reconstructed from their bones. It's the artwork that explains how the natural world around us works. And this was a perfect fit for me. I was passionate about science and nature, and I was not excited about taking math or statistics. Another perk for me is that at the time, even though computers were on the scene, illustration work was still grounded in very classic techniques. I was sharpening graphite pencils until they were as precise as tiny chisels. I was holding my breath through precise watercolor strokes on very smooth paper. I was ritualistically cleaning off the point of my steel-nibbed pens with rubbing alcohol before I dipped them back in the tiny glass bottle of ink to make more lines on the page. It was old school with a capital old. Now, my parents had been working in museums for decades. And in fact, when they needed a babysitter when I was a kid, they just kind of dropped me off on the bottom level of the museum with all the taxidermy polar bears. But that's a different story. Mom and Dad were pretty darn proud of me, despite the fact that I hadn't followed a traditional hard science approach. My dad had actually started farming out my science illustration services to his colleagues for all of their scientific papers. I was getting so good at sitting for hours and hours at a microscope looking at the tiny details of rodent teeth. I could draw the most itty-bitty nuances of enamel and dentine patterns with those tiny little metal pens in the little jar of ink. To celebrate my graduation, my parents rented a little cabin in the town of Felton, which is in the woods just north of Santa Cruz. And it was there that they gave me my very special graduation treat. It was my very own night vision camera. What? The thing was about the size of a camcorder, if anyone remembers what camcorder is. You can imagine it being about the size of a loaf of bread or so. And it had a strap on the right side where you could put your hand and then hold it up to your eye and then move it left to right. And now I'm guessing this night vision camera was originally designed as a tool for deer hunters, maybe. My parents were so sure that I was going to find it so useful for drawing pictures of wildlife in the dark. I don't know how that works. Anyway, but a new toy is a new toy. And I was pumped. I was really excited. And our little cabin in the woods was right along a creek. So I was guessing we were going to see all sorts of critters at night, right? So as soon as the sun went down, I stepped out into the warm summer night. And I turned on my night vision camera. There I was, khaki shorts, plaid flannel shirt, because this was the 90s after all. And I had so much confidence and curiosity, the way that only a 20-something kid just out of college can really have, right? So I started methodically scanning the landscape through this gadget. I swept the camera slowly across the dense forest understory from left to right. I checked the base of every shrub, and I ran it up and down every tree trunk. I was poised to revel in nature's secrets as they unveiled themselves through the power of technology. Technology, technology. Okay, that's a tree. That's a bush. And there's a shrub. And there's a tree. And that's a shrub. And that's a shrub. For like 20 minutes, I saw nothing, you guys. Nothing. But that's fine, because you can't sit at a microscope and stare at rodent teeth for a whole semester without having a lot of patience. But then I felt something. It was soft. It was brushing against the back of my leg. It almost felt like a long-haired cat. Are there cats in this neighborhood? Puzzled, I lowered my night vision camera and I looked down at the ground. Oh my God! Immediately behind me was a skunk. It was a striped skunk. Scientific name, Mephitis mephitis. Which is not a rodent, those are mustelids. They have totally different dental patterns. Evidently, I was standing right on the same path that the skunk used to do his nightly rounds through the neighborhood. And he had just given me a saucy swat with his floofy black and white tail as he walked by. My big boots were just obstructing his path, and he was just trying to scoot by. Thanks, you know, pardon me, just scooting by. I was kind of freaked out. I held very, very still. And thank goodness, that skunk stayed perfectly calm and relaxed. He was actually waddling along with just a lot of confidence and daring do, if I may say so myself. And he did not blast me with any of his super stinky self-defense spray. Now, 22 years ago, we were not all glued to smartphones day and night. We weren't obsessively thinking about social media posts and selfie potential. It was really kind of unusual at the time for me to be trying to experience wildlife through an electronic gadget. And this skunk, I honestly think he was making fun of me. I could practically see the cartoon thought bubble above his fuzzy little head, right? And he was delivering this message with utmost skunky irony. Oh, nice wildlife camera you've got up there. So you're looking for wildlife, are you? Swat. I've got your wildlife right here.
Keturah Reynolds, everybody. I really believe that nature connects us all, you know, whether you're a 100-foot-long blue whale or a tiny single-celled organism. There's a pulse and a rhythm that echoes through it all, an energy, like the energy in this room. What happens when we look deeply into the intimate connection between ourselves and the non-human world? Our next storyteller is a poet. And she wanted to let you know, she wanted you to know that her story is an act of commemoration, an enactment of remembrance, and the connection between all sentient beings. So what do we learn about ourselves when we consider that all beings are our relations? Please welcome to the stage, Xin Yi Pai.
Passengers aboard our Puget Sound-bound vessel included a bespoke shoemaker, a floral designer, and two lawyers. a group of strangers had assembled together on a rainy winter night to experience squid jigging. I was standing beside Evan, a retired smoke jumper, when he pulled the juvenile squid out of the Salish Sea. A marine biologist in residence for the night came over to examine the freshly caught specimen. I felt a terrible sense of responsibility for this animal's life. It had been preparing to spawn when the lighted lures hanging off of our barge attracted him to swim towards our vessel. The opalescent animal met my gaze with an unblinking and silent stare. As the scientist prodded the miniature squid, he released a spurt of black ink that stained the creases of Evan's weathered palm. My professional work puts me in a position to design and produce uncommon experiences for people. My friend David had come to me with the idea of organizing a squid fishing expedition that could celebrate a unique Pacific Northwest tradition, a migration that can be seen late at night along the piers of Elliott Bay and West Seattle throughout late fall and early winter. The eerie beauty of luminescent lures and fishing lines of squid jiggers rivals only the magic of walking into low tide at midnight to encounter hundreds of razor clam diggers outfitted in headlamps as they overturn sand along the shoreline. These romantic images filled my imagination when I agreed to produce the event and chartered a private boat. But I came too late to realizing the horror of what we were actually planning. A hunting expedition where kinship with nature would mean taking a life. I am a Buddhist. I've taken vows to do no harm, to respect all life, and to honor all sentient beings. David pulled out a sheet of fine art Strathmore and spread the squid's figure over the textured white paper so that the guests on the boat could examine it more closely beneath a bright light. As the group gathered around the limp squid, the marine biologist scraped a plastic fork across its body to activate a rainbow of chromatophores. I felt myself in the active act of breaking a vow. I had violated a commitment, and not only did I feel a profound disconnection to nature, I felt aware of being cut off from my own humanity. "Does it feel pain?" someone asked. Does it understand what's happening to it? The scientist was diplomatic when he declared, "They have very highly developed sensory systems." I was blinded by the tears filling my eyes and walked towards the back of the boat where I could quietly weep unnoticed as the biologist continued lecturing on cephalopod biology. I dreaded this moment the entire night and quietly prayed that we'd fail at our expedition. That moment of gazing into the eyes of a dying squid was my personal turning of the wheel. Prince Siddhartha touched it when he walked out beyond the palace walls to see a freshly plowed field that exposed the earthworms who made their homes there. The worms wriggled in distress, trying desperately to find cover, while others writhed in pain, having just been cleaved in two. All beings suffer, but in this case, I contributed to creating suffering for another soul. These events weigh upon me still. So often, communion with nature involves the sublime, some experience of obliteration. In my ill-fated fishing expedition, it included an enactment of power upon a being whose life was perceived as lesser. We were wrong. I was wrong. No life has more value than another. As the squid expired, someone bagged it and threw it into a plastic cooler. What remained was a natural imprint of the animal's body left behind on paper, in the tradition of a Japanese gyotaku, or fish print, a record of a night's catch. In another print, drips of opalescent squid ink shimmer with gold. When I look at this image, I think of kintsugi, shattered ceramics that are carefully mended with a lacquer resin mixed with powdered gold. Ruptures and mending are part of the history. The damage is visible, and still somehow unspeakable in its beauty.
Chinyupai, everybody. Chinyupai. Very touching. Thank you for sharing that experience with us, for bringing us into this emotional experience. That's a deep one. I always feel like we have so much to learn from our relationship with nature, right? We're just a small part of it. Xinyi is the former poet laureate of Redmond. Yeah, you're impressed, aren't you? Yeah. And she has a new book coming out in March from Entre Rios Books called Enso, so look out for it. Thank you again, Xinyi. Yes, why not? Now, I love Alaska. I've spent a lot of time there, and I'm passionate about the place. It feels like my second home in many ways. But I've spent enough time up there to know that the place can be rough. You know, it's an untamed landscape, and it's got a way of kicking your ass, as you guys might say. It's way more impactful, isn't it? Kicking your ass. Whichever way, Alaska can kick it, both physically and emotionally. But in the heart of every Alaskan is this spirit of resilience. So now, to close out our show tonight, please welcome Monte Montipari.
I was in my truck, driving into the darkness. It's fall in Alaska, and I was heading east across the state toward McCarthy. McCarthy is a little redneck hippie town at the end of a 60-mile dirt road in the middle of nowhere, in the middle of this nation's largest national park, Wrangell St. Elias. Don't feel bad, nobody has heard of this place. It's at the toe of a glacier, confluence of two rivers, surrounded by some of the most beautiful mountains on the planet. It might be the most magical place in the world, and I did not want to go back there. I thought about driving all the way back home to my parents' house in Colorado. I called my parents, and in over a decade as a wilderness guide in Alaska, I had never heard them so concerned for my well-being. This was different. I was devastated. The night before, I was sitting in Anchorage on a couch. I was excited to celebrate my second wedding anniversary with my wife. We'd been living apart that summer. I was living in McCarthy guiding. She was living in Anchorage pursuing her own professional goals. She was staying with friends. It was their couch. It smelled like two kids and a dog. She turned to me and said, "I cheated on you. 2 years ago, before our wedding in McCarthy, I crumpled into the linoleum, whimpering. It's not what I expected to get for my second anniversary. I hear cotton is traditional." But as the night went on and the more I found out, the less I felt like I could deal with any of this. And when it was finally revealed that it wasn't once, it was an affair, I told her I didn't feel safe there anymore. And I hugged her, I told her I loved her, I got in my truck and I drove away. I will never forget the first day I stepped foot in McCarthy, Alaska. This place was just waking up from being a ghost town. I felt like I'd rediscovered Colorado in 1970, as my parents had always described it. Dirt roads, sleeping dogs. It's the kind of place where you could go to the one bar in town and be sitting next to a gold miner and a mountain guide and the mayor. And the mayor was a dog. And I was 20 years old. This place was a blank slate for me, and I knew how small towns work. Your actions accumulate over time, and eventually your character is seen by all. I kept my nose clean. I treated people with respect. I made my way up from a first-year guide to part owner of the guide service. And even though life there can be hard sometimes, I felt protected by that place. As long as McCarthy respected me and my wife loved me, then nothing else mattered. And as I drove back into town that day, I didn't feel either of those things anymore. Some people had known the whole time. Now it felt like everybody knew. I was the last one to be told my own terrible secret. I couldn't bear to go back to our cabin alone, so I went to stay with my best friend, Chris, and his wife. And they cared for me because I was incapable of doing so for myself. I had no appetite. It was hard to sleep. When I did, I had horrific nightmares. Being awake hurt. Never had an emotional injury manifest such physical pain. If this is what it was going to be like to live, I wasn't sure I wanted to keep doing that. So after a couple days of that, I wanted to give Chris and his wife a break. Because it's difficult enough living in a one-room cabin in remote Alaska with your partner without having your broken-hearted buddy crashing your living room / dining room / only room. So when my buddy Chester asked if I wanted to crash with him for the evening, I took him up on that offer. Chris and Chester live in the same subdivision. But I feel that term is grossly misleading in this context. Think less suburbia and more a collection of shacks, shanties, cabins, treehouses, and permanently parked school buses connected by a dirt road bulldozed through the forest. So I followed Chester through the woods to his cabin. I'd met him 10 years ago that first day I got to McCarthy. We immediately bonded over a love of punk rock music. And our dogs, our sisters. And that night, we pulled an all-night heart-to-heart where I told him that this entire thing felt like the last act of some great Greek tragedy that had been specifically constructed to use my own pre-existing flaws as the very means of my destruction. I told him I had always struggled with my masculinity and that I felt completely emasculated. I told him I'd always struggled to control others' perceptions of me, and now the thing that I would like to be the most private was most public. I told him I was angry, but I didn't know what to do with it. I wasn't letting myself feel it yet because it was so intense. I woke up that morning with my 85-pound husky mutt dog on my chest in her most aggressive version yet of, maybe you'd feel just a little better if you pet a big furry dog. Chester and I got up and drank coffee, which I do, and smoked cigarettes, which I don't do, but that morning it felt like I should. And I smoked the shit out of some cigarettes. Then I left, and my cell phone died, and I realized I'd left my sleeping bag back at Chester's. So I go back, I put my sleeping bag over my shoulders, I go to leave, Chester stops me, and he puts his hand on my chest, and he says, you have an infinite well of power inside of you, which, if you knew Chester, you would know is a very Chester thing to say. It was just past peak foliage. The bright yellows were mottled. Leaves dead but not fallen yet. And I walked into the woods alone. My dogs had gone back to Chris's for breakfast. And I felt alone. I felt like my marriage was a lie. I felt like my whole life was a lie. I felt like I died on that couch. I felt lost in the world. And then I realized I was lost in the woods. I was actually lost. Which wilderness guide lost in his best friend's backyard. I was crushing it. In my defense, it's bushy back there. And Chester's the kind of dude that meticulously doesn't walk the same way just to keep it wild. Regardless, I'm disoriented. I'm trying to gain my bearings. I take a step forward. A twig snaps underfoot. I look to my left, and there's a 750-pound grizzly bear 25 yards away from me. Right? I've had a decent amount of bear encounters in my time in Alaska. I've even been mock-charged by grizzly bears, something they'll do usually at a greater distance. It's their version of pounding on their chest to assert their dominance. I've never had any animal look at me the way this bear looked at me, roared, and charged immediately. There was nothing mock going on here. This was worst case scenario. I had just startled a fall time grizzly in the bushes. I turned my head to run, which you are not supposed to do. But in my defense, it is a difficult instinct to control when presented with something this terrifying. And in that moment, I knew exactly where my bear gun was, 5 miles away on my bedside table. I didn't have any other bear spray, which is my preferred means of protection. I scanned the area for a tree to climb, somewhere to hide. There isn't one, because there never is in Alaska. What you're supposed to do in the rare event that you're attacked by a grizzly bear is play dead. Lie face down on the ground to protect your organs. Put your hands over the back of your neck to protect your spinal cord. And then let the bear maul you. Only if the attack persists. Fight for your life. I'd felt mostly dead for 4 days now. I felt like I'd been getting mauled by the world. I felt like the attack had persisted long enough. I turned around to see the bear barreling at me through the bushes. I planted my feet. I put my teal and lime green sleeping bag over my head. And when I opened my mouth, as if it was being ripped out of me, came all of my pain and confusion and directionless anger in the form of a gut wrenching, eye bulging, vein popping, primal scream. And the bear stopped. But now the bear was very close. So close that this time when it roars, I saw spittle shoot off of its lips. Its hot breath cuts through the cold morning air. But I wasn't going anywhere. I just found out I don't want to die. And if I am going to die, they're not going to find me in my friend's backyard with claw marks in my back. So I looked that bear directly in the eyes. Which you are also not supposed to do. And I dug down deep inside of me, past the burst bubble of McCarthy and the shards of my broken heart, to a place that was not broken, a place that cannot be destroyed. And from that place, I roared, and then I charged the bear. And I don't think it's what the bear expected, because it looked pretty confused and huffed and ran into the bushes. Many longtime Alaskans would tell you the moral of this story is simple. Carry your bear gun, you stupid hippie. But for me, it was immediately much more profound. I felt like the natural world had just warned me that this experience was going to summon my own personal demons in their most intense forms. And if I tried to run or hide from them, they were going to kill me. If I was going to survive, I was going to need to be brave, stand my ground, and look them right in the eye. Thank you.
I hope you all loved those stories as much as I did. We also took a video of each storyteller, and if you'd like to see them, check us out online at kuow.org/thewild or on Instagram at thewildpod. And again, we're planning another evening of storytelling from the wild, so if these stories have inspired you, seriously think about submitting your own experience on our website, or you can email us at thewild@kuow.org. This episode was produced by Matt Martin and edited by Jim Gates. The storytelling event was produced by Charlotte Durham and Bridget Anderson. We had additional help from Michaela Giannotti and Tio Popescu. Rob Jacob Springer was our audio engineer, and our videographer was Marcy Stone Francois. Michael Parker composed our theme music, and I'm Chris Morgan. Thanks for listening.